Right. Well, I have a bit of a quiz. We'll start with a quiz this morning. Does anyone know how long a human can survive without food? Any idea? Yes. Oh, a little bit longer. Oh. 21
days.
How many? 21
days.
Yeah, about 3 weeks, roughly. Some people have gone like much longer, but yeah, about 3 weeks. What about water? How long can a human survive without water? 3 days, yeah. So we got 3 weeks, 3 days. What about how long can a human survive without air, without oxygen? About 3 minutes. Yeah, 3 minutes. So 3 weeks, 3 days. Of course, there's a bit of a range in there. Now, that's very basic, isn't it? We're not really invincible creatures. We're not really powerful in ourselves. This is just 3 minutes without oxygen, and then we cease to exist. That's pretty crazy when you think about it. Even though it's obviously true we're not independently invincible, what we really like to do is construct these elaborate stories to kind of prove to ourselves that actually, no, we are independently invincible, thanks very much, and I am basically functionally my own God. Well, if you're like me at all, too, you don't like depending on other stuff. You like just having all the things yourselves, and especially depending on other people, that's the worst, right? Other people have to come through for you. Oh, that's horrible. If we had a choice, it would really just be our own God. Living as your own God is initially very attractive, which is why we all do it, because we like to be in control. We get to do what we want to do, when we want to do it, but we really are not made for that. With control, see, control in itself is not a separate thing. There's all these ties to all sorts of other things. If we get all control, it's also tied to other things like anxiety, exhaustion, burnout, all that kind of stuff. We are anxious as independent creatures because we just don't have what it takes to be ultimately in control. And if we are the ones who are ultimately in control of everything, how in the world could we ever take a nap? How could we ever take a break if we're actually in control? We like being our own gods, but we're poor gods in ourselves. We think and we act like we're a god, but we're so clearly not. There's no room for rest if we're gods. And what we've done is we trade rest for anxiety, exhaustion, and sadness, and stress. Look, we're just not enough, so what are we gonna do? We can either keep on the path that we know is messed up. I'm going to be my own God anyway, and maybe it's kind of messed up, but I'll just get by. Or we'll find something else and stay on that path, something better, one that's good, where we can find some actual real deep rest. And this is exactly where Jesus comes in our story today. We need Jesus to save us from ourselves and our stories of self-worship, and he brings us into his story. Now, a lot of these verses that we just read can probably seem, at least at the first light, to be an irrelevant theological discussion over like some aspect of the Sabbath. How do you celebrate the Sabbath? What's to do here? But I think once we look at the story for a bit, we're gonna understand how it's incredibly relevant to our lives. And I think our story today is kind of similar to Jaws. Jaws is a film about a shark, but it's not about a shark. It's not about a shark. It's the crisis of masculinity. It's about a man who's unable to protect his family, protect his community. It's about coming into contact with something far more powerful and not even understandable. That's what Jaws is really. It's a shark about a shark. It's like if you were to say, what is Moby Dick about? It's not really about a whale. There's a whale in it, and without the whale, there is no story, but it's not really about the whale. They might have a shark or a whale in them, but these stories, ultimately, it's not what the story is about. And I think that's the deal with our story today. It's a story about the Sabbath. It's not really about the Sabbath. It's about something far bigger, and it uses the Sabbath to tell the story. And we will learn about the Sabbath as we go through, but there's a bigger thing at play. Because what this does is it uses the Sabbath, and we'll talk about what that means in a moment, to illustrate a larger point. And that means it's important for us to understand what the Sabbath is about if we're going to use that as a working model. Now, the people that Matthew is writing to, the people that Jesus is speaking to here, they would have a very deep understanding about the Sabbath in ways that we probably don't, most of us. So let's just take a broad look at what the Sabbath actually is. And if you've heard that term before, maybe you have if you've been around the church for a long time, and you're not really sure what it means, it just means a day of rest, a day set apart from other ones. A week has 7 days, 6 days for work. One of them is to be something different than that. It's for rest. But let's start at the beginning. Here's a bit of a idea here. When God created the world, starting all the way on the left side in creation, the Bible says he worked for 6 days, he saw it was really good, and then he took a rest. He rested for one. He made that seventh day holy. To be holy means many things. One of them it means is to be set apart. So it's a different kind of day than the previous six. And that's all we get from the first chapters of Genesis. No rules, just a statement of what God has done. God is the one who starts the Sabbath, and God is the first one to celebrate the Sabbath. So then we move on to Old Testament Israel, that little blue section there. As we move along in history in the Old Testament, we get stuff like the Ten Commandments, like the encapsulation of God's law. One of the Ten Commandments God gave for his people is to keep the seventh day holy, to keep it separate. God elaborates and describes what that means. He says, don't work. You got six other days for that. This is a day where you don't do that, and you're going to worship me. That's what Sabbath means, worship, rest, all that kind of restoration stuff. And then even in those Ten Commandments, as God's people, we're called to imitate how God lives. It's supposed to basically be like our dad. Later on, God promises his people a particular place. This is where it gets a little bit more complex. So God promises his people a particular place, and that's called the Promised Land. So there's a promised time of rest, but now there's a promised land of rest. And Joshua, when God's people is going to become Israel, in this land that God has promised them, the promised land, it calls itself a place of rest. So we have a time and we have a place. It's getting a bit complex, but the author of Hebrews helps us understand this a little bit. The author of Hebrews, and this is a book in the New Testament, teaches us what the Sabbath is about a little bit, helps us understand it. It says, though Joshua led the Israelites into the place of rest, their promise of God's rest still stands for God's people. So they were following in the time, they're following the place. They went in this land, they had a specific land that was for them then. And then all of a sudden, there was still something beyond which that God's people were supposed to be led into. I'm not sure what I did, but I think I fixed it. I won't move. So the Israelites went into the land, but for the Israelite, for God's people, the promise of rest still stands. Okay, so even though they're there, they're not quite there. So let's go forward to Jesus' day. By the time we get to Jesus' day, where we find ourselves in the story today, there are lots of writings, lots of rules beyond what the Old Testament taught about the Sabbath. 39 very specific rules, and everybody knew them, because to keep the Sabbath was a marker of identity. It was a way to signal to others, this is who I am. If I keep the Sabbath, I'm Jewish. And they were not interchangeable. Keeping the Sabbath meant Jewish, and if you're Jewish, you keep the Sabbath in those very specific ways. That rule became a part of who they were, became a part of their identity. And then here come these disciples. They're breaking four of these rules in one go. You can imagine why this would be such a big deal. It's like if I came in with the Union Jack and burned it in front of you, you'd be like, this is not okay. It would freak you out, as it ought to. So, we looked a little bit at the history. Creation, Israel, Jesus' day. Let's look, our next stop on the Sabbath tour is the future, what that looks like. By the time we got to Jesus, all sorts of these extra rules are placed on top. But really, ultimately, what the Bible teaches about Sabbath, about rest, about whatever, however words we can use for that, restoration, is that Sabbath is the end goal of creation. It's the whole point. It's where everybody is going, where God is taking all of his people. It's about complete restoration. It's a time and a place. In Revelation, which is the last book of the Bible, we're given pictures. Sorry, I'm going to move this. Maybe if I move it up here. In Revelation, the last book of the Bible, we're giving pictures of what this restoration looks like. It's the whole earth remade. The whole earth restored. Not just one little small section of it, not just one little time, not just one little place, it's the entire earth completely remade. A time and a place of rest that goes on and on and on and never ends. This is more than just a rule to follow one day a week. And that means our little Sabbath that we celebrate one day a week, a day like today. The people of God are now called, we're called to celebrate that. They're not an end in themselves. They're not a rule in themselves. What they are little tiny pointers to where we're going. And just like how manna fell in the Old Testament for people in the wilderness, it's a part also of that future breaking into our today. A little bit of that rest breaks into our today. The restoration, when everything that's broken will be made new. They reflect, our little Sabbaths reflect this cosmic restoration, which really ought to be a celebration. So that's kind of a brief overview of the Sabbath, and that was very quick, and if you got maybe 5% of it, that's completely fine. It's a little 5% than what we had before. Let's get back to Matthew's story today. The reason why we did that is because without understanding a little bit about the Sabbath, we'll miss what Jesus is trying to say. See, the religious leaders of the day, they completely miss the forest for the trees. Do you think the way they're acting doesn't seem like they got the idea that Sabbath is the end goal of creation? And they also do not seem to humbly maybe learn from the one who calls himself the Lord of the Sabbath, the Lord of rest. They lost sight of God's plan because their identities were caught up in following rules. And in pointing a finger at them, what Matthew wants us to do is turn that around and point that finger at ourselves, to ask these questions about ourselves. So because Jesus says he is the Lord of the Sabbath, the Lord of rest, we need to know what that means when he says that. The Lord over the restoration of everything. And what Jesus does in this story is two things. He tells us about it, and then he shows us. He declares how he's the Lord of rest, and then he shows us what it means to be the Lord of rest. He demonstrates it. He tells us, then he shows us. So we're going to look at those two things, and then we'll talk about briefly why that is actually really good news for us. So let's first talk about Jesus' declaration. The first eight verses, Jesus is telling people who he is, makes it very clear. Jesus and the disciples, they're walking on these kind of walking around on the Sabbath, and all of a sudden they're eating some grain at the edges of other people's fields. And this is completely okay to do, except for today. Today's the Sabbath, and we don't do that. And so in that small little section of a verse, they break four rules. They reap, they winnow, they prepare, and something else. Thresh. I don't know what reaping or threshing or winnowing is. I do know what preparing is, but all those things they're doing all in those one little in that one little verse. It's a lot of rules to break in that little act. Now notice, they're not breaking any biblical laws. They're breaking only all the kind of extra laws that the people put on top of what God had already said. Now some of the Pharisees, these religious leaders of the day, they speak up. And you notice the way they speak, it's as if everyone would understand what they're talking about. This is so ingrained in the people at the time. It's common knowledge. So I'm sure the disciples knew what they were doing. Of course they did. It didn't take them by surprise. But the religious leaders are scandalized. And Jesus says back with a biting reply, "Don't you know the story of David when he ate the consecrated bread?" Now, you may not know that story, and we'll get to that in a second. But of course the people he's speaking to did. That's like their whole thing. They pride themselves on how well they knew the Old Testament and applied Old Testament laws. What Jesus was saying is, you might know this story, but you don't know this story. You don't understand what this story is really about, because they were acting as if they didn't know it. So, very briefly, you may not be as familiar with it as the Pharisees were, but what Jesus is talking about is a story from 1 Samuel 21, where David, the famous King David of Israel, like the most famous, best king Israel ever had, King David, before he was king, he was fleeing the king at the time, Saul. Saul was not a very good king. Saul was on a rampage. He wanted to kill David. So David, he had his crew with him. They were running away. They didn't want to die. He was on the run and running low on food, kind of on the verge of starvation. He went to the high priest at the temple for food, and the only food available at the time was this special set-apart bread called consecrated bread, or bread of the presence. It was a bread that only priests were allowed to eat. This bread was not for everyone. Now, David wasn't a priest. He wasn't even officially king yet. Technically, he wasn't even allowed to eat it, and yet the high priest gave his approval to David to eat this bread. So David ate it, and he gave it to the rest of his crew who were with him, and they didn't starve to death. Now, when Jesus brings this up, he's asking these questions. It kind of keeps going, asking these questions. We don't hear a response from the religious leaders. I'm not sure. Maybe Matthew didn't record it. Maybe they didn't say anything. I think probably they didn't know what to say. Like, why in the world is he bringing that story up here? They knew that story, but they didn't know the story. They weren't able to understand it or get why Jesus would bring it up now. So why this weird kind of David story? Why did he bring that up then? Well, the symbol of David acting like a priest by eating this special bread was a symbol of who God is and how God loves his people. God, through the person of Jesus, is our priest. It's who he is. He cares for us. We don't have to care for him. This is the only kind of religion in the world set this way, by the way. Every other religion, you have to care for the God. This, our religion, Christianity, God cares for you. He leads and cares for his people. And through him, we have what we need. He's not a slave driver. If we're hungry, he gives us bread. He's the Lord of rest. That's just who Jesus is. Now, before we get any kind of response from these religious leaders, Jesus makes it clear. He's like, if you don't get it, I'm going to let you know. The Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. That's who I am, aka the Lord of rest. If you've ever thought or come across people who said that Jesus is a good teacher but never claimed to be the Lord, this is one of the many texts where that's just not true. And if he's a good teacher and he isn't God, he's not that great of a teacher because he calls himself God all the time. So Jesus is the Lord of the Sabbath. Now, just take a moment and think of the hubris of the Pharisees. The Pharisees that are trying, that, so Jesus just said he's Lord. That means he's God, saying he's God. He created everything, including them. He's the one who gave the law to Israel, the very law they claim to devote themselves to. So the law scholars look up at the lawgiver and dare to shake their fingers. He goes after the Pharisees who pride themselves on knowledge, saying they don't actually understand anything at all. And then he declares his lordship over and above it. See, Jesus' lordship is in direct conflict with theirs, just as Jesus' lordship is in direct conflict with what we think ours is. Like the Pharisees, you will be offended because all of your best qualities that you pride yourself on, that you get your identity from, that you really like can rest in and rely on, all of your best qualities pale in comparison to his. All that we've built our identity on outside of him will be rightly rattled until it's broken when we come face to face with Jesus. See, the thing is, everyone's going to be offended by Jesus. Every single person in the world who's ever heard him will be offended by him. But those who follow him get to be lifted up by him as well. We're all offended by Jesus. Jesus is the one, though, if we follow him, he gets to lift us up. And when he lifts us up, when we follow him, what we get is we get to be made into something more, with a freedom that we didn't have before, because now we don't have to rely on ourselves. We can rely on an all-powerful, all-loving God instead. And when we follow Jesus, he's the one who cares for us. Your career is never going to do that. Your family might do that a little bit. It's not going to be enough. Your partner might love you, but they're not completely perfect and all-powerful. All those things, whatever the things are, they're just not enough. Jesus is our carrier, a priest that gives us his bread and tells us to eat. He gives us rest. The most important question we can ask ourselves is, who is Jesus to me? And maybe you're not a follower of Jesus yet, but you're curious. This is the question that is worth investigating in order to answer. Now, if you are a Christian, you would say, of course Jesus leads us to rest. Of course he has grace for us. Of course he has authority over my life. Well, then why are we so anxious, exhausted, and stressed out all the time? Why are we caught up in the hustle culture of always working at something 24/7? And if we don't, we feel guilty. There's parts of our hearts that are all there. If he is the Lord, the great thing, it means you don't have to be. We're free from having to be the Lord. You don't have to be Jesus. He's enough for all of us. And then you can get rest. Now, if you're not here because you're ill or your kids are ill or all the kind of insanity of life, and I know there's a lot of people watching online, I hope that need of rest that we all need to hear is really coming through. And the great thing with Jesus, he tells us these things, but we don't just get lip service from him. He actually shows us through his actions and how he actually lives this out. He demonstrates his lordship to us. Now, Matthew does this very interesting thing. It's a different Sabbath day, but he puts these two stories right together. He's trying to tell us something about what's going on here. So the healing that Jesus does takes place on a different Sabbath day. It's a whole different Sabbath day altogether. And Jesus is teaching in the synagogue. There was a man whose hand was shriveled. We don't know if he was born like that or if there's some kind of accident. All we know is that his arm is just not working as it ought to be. The religious leaders, they all have their eyes on Jesus because they just know he loves to heal people, this guy. He's horrible. He's going to heal somebody. It's going to be on the Sabbath. I'm going to be so angry about it. I'm going to catch him. That's what the religious leaders are just kind of seething underneath the surface. Jesus is horrible like that. He loves to heal people. See, Jesus, knowing what these religious leaders were up to, made an example of this man. A big, huge synagogue meeting. The whole like Jewish community is there. And he makes this man stand up in front of everybody and in view of everyone. He teaches us about the Sabbath. What is the Sabbath for? It's for doing good. It's for healing. It's restoring. That's rest. There is no restoration without rest. And then he healed the man's arm. Now, the religious leaders were so angry. Like it's like an irrational rage. They wanted to kill Jesus. So what's going on here? Well, Jesus is teaching us what the Sabbath is about. But more importantly, because it's about the Sabbath, but not about the Sabbath, he's teaching us about who he is. He's already declared himself to be Lord. Now he shows us exactly what kind of Lord he is. There'd be all sorts of lords out there. What's the best kind of Lord out there? In reality, Jesus could have waited to heal this man. He could have healed him on the previous day. Could have healed him on the next day. He could have healed him in private instead of public. But now he's making a point. This is like the punk rock rebel Jesus doing the thing that he likes to do, showing everybody who he is. Very bold. And he confronts the religious right and asks them what the Sabbath is for. To show his answer, he teaches them about what the Sabbath has always been about, to do good, to bring in life, to restore what's broken, to make whole. And then Jesus restores this man's hand. How amazing would that be if that just happened? You're like sat next to the guy and all of a sudden it's restored. I mean, what did that look like? Did it make a sound or like what was it like? That must have been crazy to think. My mind would be, I don't have a category for that. I've never seen that happen. My mind would be blown. I would have no idea what to think about. And yet, the religious types are now angry. They're filled with fury, irrational, uncontrollable rage. Jesus made a man whole, and they want to kill him. Jesus' authority and his grace has brought wholeness, and in doing so, it exposes the Pharisees' hearts. They don't seem to care that this man with a withered arm is now restored. How in the world did that affect his life and hold him back? Have you ever, like, broken a collarbone or messed your shoulder up or with your arm? All of a sudden, normal life just can't really work anymore. It's really difficult. And who knows what this guy, how this guy worked for a living? Did he have a family he had to support? Did then he have to rely on other family members? We don't know all those things. But here Jesus comes, he sees the damaged thing, and he sets it right. This is Sabbath restoration. Everyone should have been in awe, but instead at least some were furious. Jesus' authority and grace has exposed their hearts and exposes ours as well. Jesus' authority and his grace, both of those two things that have to work together, they expose us kind of where we are. With Jesus' authority, his claims of authority confront our own claims. Again, we want to be our own gods, but then in order to surrender to Jesus, we have to give up that authority ourselves. We think we're in control. We work, we get paid, get the paycheck, we buy food, we pay rent. And though on the surface, yeah, that's true, it's like there's a lot of other things that are going on below that. You're just one small step away from your whole world being the opposite. Jesus is actually in control. Who do you think allows you to work? Who do you think provides the food you eat, the place you live? It's actually really Jesus. And that can make us angry because we did it. We should get paid because I did the work and that's like my job and we like our control. And you know, most of this world is set up to give us that illusion that we're in control. But if that's true, why do we still create problems for ourselves? We just are not strong enough. Why are we worn out? We can't work enough. We don't even talk about rest if you're in control. Our own anxiety betrays the fact that we know we don't have what it takes to be in control, but we're afraid of having to give something up at the same time. So we know it's not good, but like maybe it's bad out there. I don't know. So we have this kung fu death grip on our control that we just can't give up, and it leads to exactly that. It leads to death. But this, surrender, leads to life. It's how you receive. It's also how you surrender. It's the same posture. The good news is that Jesus is in control, so we don't have to be. And Jesus' grace, his grace, well, that confronts our own self-righteousness. Why would the Pharisees get offended that Jesus healed some other guy? Jesus is undermining their whole system of what it means to be good. For the Pharisees, to do good is how you are good. It's an ongoing thing, and so you have to keep doing good if you want to be good. That's who they are. Surely that's most people we know today. In order to be good, you have to do good. And Jesus has just pulled the rug out from underneath them. Here comes this guy claiming to be God, claiming to be good, and if this is what goodness looks like, they've actually got the whole thing wrong. They have to reset their entire life. They have to do a 180 and walk in a whole different way. Their whole life has been upside down. Of course they'd be irrationally furious. So would we. So are we. See, we are also self-righteous, but blind to it. And then Jesus comes along. He shows grace in these extravagant, unorthodox, and surprising ways. And that is offensive, because they don't deserve it. Of course, we deserve it, right? We're good. But those people, I don't know about those people. I don't think they deserve it. Here's the wonderful thing about it all, though. We, even the self-righteous, can be included in Jesus' extravagant, unorthodox, and surprising grace. The Pharisees are a picture of us, but you know what else is a picture of us? And maybe the better picture of us? That withered hand. That's really who we are in this story. We are that withered hand. And broken, in need of restoration, completely hopeless by itself, completely useless by itself. And here comes the Lord and all his authority, and what comes out? Grace comes out. That's what he wants to come out. Grace comes out. Love comes out. Healing comes out. Restoration comes out. And now that we get to be whole, now that we're restored, we actually have a purpose that we didn't have before, because then we were just hanging limply on the side of something. Now we can actually do something. We have a trajectory. We have a new goal. If we follow Jesus, and there are places where he goes that we'll find at times for us will be uncomfortable. Find at times for us will be scary. Find at times for us we won't know what the words we have to say or what we ought to do in the moment. But the great thing is that Jesus is gracious. The one who led us there is also gracious to us in the moment. And we can rest in the fact he is always working for our good and will never leave us. See, we once were relying on ourselves for meaning and control on our own terms, hanging down off a shoulder as an utterly useless and purposeless arm. And now we're confronted with Jesus and what he does. It's a crazy thing. He gives us a new life, gives us a new identity, a new purpose to be lived out in his grace. Now, why? How could this possibly be good news? Well, without Jesus, really, all of us here would be rule-following zealots, full of self-righteousness. Without Jesus, we are hopeless. And I don't want anyone to join that. I don't want to be a part of that either. That's not very attractive, although that's how we'll all end up. Without Jesus, we are just a useless, withered hand, unable to do anything useful. And you know, often one leads to another. If you're zealous about something, if you have a lot of passion towards something, eventually you're going to burn out and you're going to end up completely useless about that thing. I've seen it happen so many times. Being led by an empty religion of rules without the Lord of rest in charge, that really wears you out. No matter your passion, eventually you'll just wither away. But thankfully in all of this, Jesus sees us and he heals us. And sometimes in really surprising ways, in ways that we would not expect, maybe also in ways we kind of don't want. But it is the best news that we get to know someone who makes us whole. Now, if we zoom out and think of the story of the Sabbath, from creation to new creation, we see not only is there personal change, as amazing as that could be, even if that's the only thing that changes my own personal life, that's great. What we actually see is this whole world will change. Jesus isn't in the business of only creating individuals. He's in the business of recreating this entire world, creating a people. The Lord of the Sabbath, from his throne, tells us today, look, right now I'm making all things new. When the Lord of rest died on the cross for us, he took all of our brokenness, all the withered parts of our world upon himself, and we have contributed to those withered parts of this world. That's called sin. We do that all the time, every single day, more often than we know. And when he resurrected, he delivered himself whole, and now all of us who follow him, we get to be made whole and proclaim that wholeness in extravagant, surprising, and often unorthodox kind of ways. So the causes or the missions in your hearts that you so desperately want to be a part of, that you're so passionate about, persecuted Christians, refugees and bystanders of war, especially now, people without homes, friends and family members who don't know Jesus yet, children who need fathers and mothers and families, the care of God's creation, whatever it might be, there's loads of things. These are all parts of our withered world that our Lord is in the process of making right. He's healing even now. And the great thing is it's not in our power, but in his power. He doesn't just lead us and leave us. He gives us his spirit, his Holy Spirit. Just as King David in the Old Testament gave that bread to people who followed him, Jesus gives himself to those who follow him. We are free from relying on ourselves. He gives us the gift of his spirit when we choose to follow him, and that's what keeps us going. And this is why we bring ourselves to the table, and we celebrate this every week at Redeemer so we can remember it and get it into our bones, that we belong to the Lord of the Sabbath. And because of that, we need his